Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
This song goes out to a very special person who was recuperating today. I hope the song makes her feel better. This is the Savage Nation. You know, I wanted to talk about some topic, like from the idle rich to the idle poor. I mean, I thought it was very clever when I wrote it this morning, but now it's as clever as when I wrote it. Let me hear Earth Angel for a minute. Don't let me interrupt the reverie. Bumping and the grinding with the old joke. Yeah, they're transfusion trees. Where is she now? Where is she now? The girl that your heart beat for so many years ago in the basement listening to this song. Transfusion tree, the false teeth. Look, it's the way of all flesh, you know. You're only one step behind anyway, so you can keep laughing as the Undertaker waits for you. Ah, it's so hot out there. Where is Al going now that we don't need him? Thank God. Okay, turn it off. Thank God Al Gore got in trouble with the massage therapists all over the country. And that put a rest to the global warming thing for a while. If only the imam was caught with his hands on someone, my God, the world would be perfect. So I was thinking this morning about this, from the idle rich to the idle poor. Everything is reversed in Obama's America. Remember, we used to hear about the idle rich. Oh, the idle rich, they did nothing. But today, it's the rich who supply all of the tax base for the idle poor. There are millions of people who sit around all day long doing nothing but complaining that there's not enough for them. They're what I call the idle poor. Millions of deadbeats from Maine to Mexico pouring into this country to live off the so-called idle rich who provide the entire wealth of the nation. That's what I mean when I say we've gone from the idle rich to the idle poor. Everyone I know who's rich works 7 days a week, incidentally. I know several wealthy people. They work 7 days a week. They never stop working. The poor work no days a week. But then you know all of this. And where is Obama while all this is going on? Obama poses as a Robin Hood who robs from the rich to give to the poor. That's the mythology. When in fact, Obama's robbing from the middle class to give to the rich who put him in business. Mainly the rich who are congregating at Martha's Vineyard right now, where the grapes of wrath are not only stored, but a new vintage is being prepared for America to drink. A new vintage from the grapes of wrath being concocted on Martha's Vineyard as we speak this August, as their puppet plays in the sand and the sun, or shall I say the rain, as he plays night basketball indoors. The very men who gave us the housing bubble are planning the next bubble, so that the average hardworking so-called rich person, meaning those who make, oh, I don't know, over $250,000 a year, the ma-and-pa hardware store, the real estate brokers, even two civil servants working together today make about $250,000 a year. But they're considered the rich today. They're the target. You may call them the idle rich, but no, my friends, they are the wealth creators of this nation. It's the idle poor who we are talking about, who are sucking the nation dry along with the bankers, who are planning the next bubble. So we have gone from the idle rich to the idle poor. Anyway, that sounded good this morning, and then I took a look at the news. And I saw that Los Angeles has unveiled a $600 million school, the costliest in the world. The costliest school in the world built for the drug addicts and sex maniacs who will go to the Visual and Performing Arts High School in Los Angeles. The school is opening next month. It costs $600 million. This is after they fired teachers, didn't buy new textbooks, paid nothing for new curricula. The K-12 complex, oh, it's a K-12 complex for the artsy-fartsy. It's unbelievable to me. And you should hear the people justifying the school. Now, the big winners here are the contractors and the unions. But this school features so many things, you know, that I don't even want to talk about. Velvet seats in the auditorium, a dining room that's better than most restaurants in L.A., state-of-the-art swimming pool. I had a swimming pool in Jamaica High School. And what's the big deal? So what's $600 million here, $600 million there? You know, they don't even have hot tubs in the school for the kids. They don't even have optional clothing in the hallways. I mean, what's the big deal? If it was L.A., they should have clothing optional classes where some of the children of the Hollywood elite can come naked, because this is a big deal. So they have a swimming pool, wireless internet. Anyway, you get the picture. So we're building Taj Mahals for the children, and the textbooks are not being bought. The teachers are being laid off. So what are you going to say about it? Nothing. What I really wanted to talk about was this. I was going to talk about the Ground Zero Mosque. We exposed the imam behind it, where he said Al-Qaeda is not as bad as America. Of course, a total lie, made the whole thing up. But he gets away with it because of his friends at General Electric and in the White House. And then I said this is boring to the average person. And today, frankly, I'm like a space cadet today. It is so hot here. We had the coldest summer on record. Well, to me, I've lived in the Bay Area since 74, and I love the cold August. This was beyond. Never a warm day for a month, like nuclear winter. I was wearing a pea coat last week. It's 104 degrees out there now. 104 degrees. How do human beings survive without air conditioning? I asked myself. I can't go outside. I gag. How do people live in Florida? I have a place in Florida. I can't go near it for 6 months a year. I gag when I go outside. You go outside in Florida after like May, there's no air. You feel as though you put your head in the air. It's impossible. So I come to the Bay Area. You're going to have the heat wave in a couple of days. So this is a low pressure zone. It's very hard for me, even with a PhD, to understand low and high pressure. It should be reversed. But a high pressure system, it's cool here when we have a high pressure system, because that somehow brings in the coastal fog. I don't know why. Presses down on the fog and pushes it onto the... A low-pressure system lets the hot air from the desert get sucked up to Northern California. So I'm suffering, not really because I'm in air conditioning. You remember the day of the no-air-conditioned car? And you still see people, by the way, without air-conditioned cars, the diehards. They usually like to drive old Jeep Wranglers from the 60s to show they're true Americans. They voted for Ronald Reagan, and they're true Americans. Or they have pickup trucks that pollute like, they won't drive a Toyota pickup truck. They drive like a 1972 Chevy pickup truck like Clint Eastwood in a hit movie of some kind. And they have like a redneck arm out of the window that's burning up with no air conditioning. You look at them like they're insane. I mean, what are they trying to prove? That they're HUD? Who do they think they are, Paul Newman in the movie HUD? I don't understand this. You turn the air conditioning on. I have a 65 Caddy. The air conditioning is still like a refrigerator. But do you remember the age of cars without air conditioning? I was thinking about that today because it's so hot. And we have got plenty of time for politics. I mean, come September, you're going to hear nothing but politics. Imam Raf, there's a word for it that I can't use who he is. Let's just put it to you this way. You won't be hearing from Imam Raf too soon. When I saw they brought out the cardinal, the head guy with the hat from New York, to talk about moving the old Mosqueroo from the Burlington Coat Factory, I knew already it was over. All right, well, once the Cardinal finally came out and took a stand, I said, it's all over. They're going to move this group of radical troublemakers uptown somewhere where they belong. I said to myself, I thought, I hope, perhaps, maybe the Catholics still have some clout in New York. I pray to God. So I was thinking about no air conditioning, the age of cars with no air conditioning. Do you remember cars like that? My father had a DeSoto with a roof rack. And every summer would come, and we'd pack the car up to go to the Catskill Mountains and load the car up. We stayed in little cottages. They called them bungalows, but they were wonderful. The whole family went in one room. It had one toilet, one bedroom, one little kitchenette. And somehow my mother could still knock out four meals a day. I never saw anything like it. She did it with four burners. And all your neighbors from the same building went up to the same little bungalow colony, and they rented cottages. You saw all your friends from all year were with you. And all your friends' mothers were there, so you were totally in your own world. But now you were playing Indians in the woods. It was gorgeous. And he'd pack the DeSoto with the roof rack. He was so meticulous, my father, God rest his soul. It took him hours to pack that car. It was like the Conestoga wagon going west. It was a 70-mile ride, but to me, it was the grapes of wrath every summer. I loved it. You'd get out of school a couple of weeks early. My father would be in the street with the ropes on the rack. And he had special moving blankets, and I thought that was very impressive. Like, other guys would use regular bed blankets. My father had friends in the moving business. He had the quilts. And by the way, they were very nice to lie in under a tree, incidentally. Even when you were, like, prepubescent, they were nice. But even afterwards, when they had another meaning, they became even better. And he would put these over the furnishings, and then Tippy the dog was put in the front seat for the ride, the 2.5-hour ride up in the heat, no air conditioning. And I think even if we had air conditioning, he wouldn't have permitted us to put it on. He wouldn't let it on. No air conditioning, it's bad for you. You'd hear things like that. I mean, he wouldn't let me put a radio on when we went to work. I told you those stories. If I was driving into work with him, a grim, it was like a black and white movie with him. You talk about why I'm still working. I don't have to work. I work because the work ethic was beaten into me where I don't know anything else. Forgive me, I'm a slave. I know nothing but work. That's what the work ethic is. It's slavery. I should be like you, taking drugs, going to doctors, and be on 17 medications and think I'm happy because I'm going to Provence to eat chocolate and drink bad wine. So they didn't use air conditioning. Many of them didn't believe in it. They didn't believe in anything that we believe in today. And we get in the car and Tippy, and he taped the door. So the Tippy the dog, the Paw Chow dog, his arms would be over the side for the whole ride up so he wouldn't scratch the finish. I don't know how he figured these things out, but he taped like a certain thing on the outside of the door so the Tippy's paws could be out and it wouldn't scratch the door. And the whole way the monster, the face was outside, scaring cars all the way on Route 17. Every car that went by, they looked the other way. They saw this ferocious-looking killer animal leaning out of the window. Well, those were the days. Those were the days. Those were beautiful days. But they didn't have air conditioning is the point. I don't know how people live without air conditioning. Did you ever live without air conditioning? We all lived in one apartment. My grandmother, three children, the two parents. We all slept in one room. And somehow we survived. How is that possible? How is it possible that I was able to go on and achieve anything? I mean, by current psychology and by current government edict, a child is not only supposed to have his own room to himself in order to grow up healthfully and to become a productive citizen, the child needs an entire zip code to themselves, never mind their own bedroom. Not only their own house, but their own zip code for independent learning and to grow up independently of the parents. They need their own zip code. I grew up in one room. Even with a grandmother, I loved having grandma around. She spoke to me in a foreign language I didn't understand, but today I dream in that language. Would you believe this? This is a true story. The woman spoke to me in a foreign language that I didn't understand the word of, but I knew every word she was saying. I can't speak it. I can't read it today, but I dream in this language to this day. So maybe if I get knocked on the head, I'll start speaking in Russian. I don't really know. It might come in handy someday if I go to a Russian bakery. It's a terrible thing. I wish Russians had good food. It killed everybody I knew. The worst food on the earth is Russian food. I have no idea why anybody would go to a Russian restaurant other than for the nice people and the good times. But the food is salty, contaminated. Who eats caviar? Who knows better? Caviar or fish eggs, right? Cholesterol rich and the fish is toxic. Where do you think the fish come from that they get the caviar from? The carp, for example. The carp probably comes from the Black Sea, which was polluted when Moses was walking on the earth. It was already polluted from lead batteries dropped here by the travelers from Mars. That's where they dumped lead batteries was in the Dead Sea. That's why it became a Dead Sea. It used to be like Lake Ronkonkoma. But they put so many batteries in with a spaceship that eventually Louis Farrakhan came along. And the next thing you knew, the Scientologist followed him. I'll be right back.
I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
Ming, we got 101 degrees here in San Francisco right now, which is a shocker. Turn it off already with that cannon singing. I didn't like it in the fifth grade. I don't like it in the 101 degrees in San Francisco. This has to be a record. Thank God Gore got caught up with the masseuse, the massage therapist thing. We wouldn't hear the end of this. My God. You don't hear from him when it's cold in San Francisco. But like one of the animals that come out. A woodchuck. What's that animal that comes out? A bread hog? Oh, groundhog. He's got to be hiding him like a bread hog. No, groundhog. Groundhog. But thank God it's only for 101 degrees in San Francisco. Tomorrow, 72. Then Thursday, the fog comes. Thank God. 63, Friday 61. And the weekend when I need the warm weather for the boat, or ice cold again, another nuclear winter. Today when I'm working, I don't have a... It's unbelievable. That's the way it is. You can't control the weather. Al Gore thought he was God and thought he could control it, like all liberals. They're all godless, but they think they're demigods. So that's why they believe they can control the weather by not passing gas or belching. Everything they're concerned about carbon. Everything the idiots don't even know what carbon is. They have no idea what carbon is. They know what carbon dioxide is bad. What they're really angry at is that their grandfather drank too much seltzer. That's what's really bothering them, but they don't even know it. It was the seltzer bottles in New York that caused global warming. Had they only known that their grandchildren would all be psychotic global warming fanatics, perhaps the seltzer bottle would have been killed years ago. And to top it off, the seltzer bottles were made of leaded glass, I think. There was a lot of lead content in it. That's why your grandfather made so much sense. At least he had some lead in his brain. You notice how pure, the more pure people get, the stupider they become? I noticed that. The more purified their diets are, the more purified their water and their air and vegetarian, lacto, ovo, schmovo, hovo, hobo, lacto, lacto, ovo, everything purified. Idiots, psychotic, they can't even think. You give the guy who eats a meat sandwich, he can put two and two together because he's got enough carnitine, iron, B6, etc. for his brain to function because he knows he's an animal, a carnivore. They think that they've ascended to the level of the heaven and they should be living on Mountain Dew, and I don't mean the soda. You see, you thought I'd be talking about Imam Raf, the Muslim preacher who they said was such a wonderful guy who turns out wasn't so wonderful. But I think the Imam's going to extend his trip in the Middle East, something tells me. Something tells me Imam Raf's going to go on a little extended tour this time. Instead of coming back for a little, little standing ovation in the Symphony Hall there in New York, something tells me he'll go on to Malaysia for another honorary degree from Al-Qaeda. I was also going to talk about business segments today, like, do you still believe in the stock market? Have you changed your investment strategy? Like a dry topic, because a lot of people are predicting a blowout coming, like a heart attack of the economy, a real heart attack. And a stroke combined.
Savage.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the one.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation, broadcasting live from a tower somewhere in San Francisco, where it's 101 degrees in downtown San Francisco. I don't know if it's a record. I'll have to look it up. I know we've had days like this in the 1890s, before Al Gore's grandfather was even a wildcatter. Before there was even a Model T Ford, there were days of 101, but not for a long time. And this is unbelievable. We had the cold, now the hot, then it's going to get cold and 30-degree drop in the next few days. I'm telling you this. The first rule of National Talk Radio, when I learned 15 years ago, never talk about the weather, never give the time, because you're across time zones and the weather's different everywhere. Well, you're wrong. First of all, weather you can talk about if you know how to talk about it wherever you are, because it relates. And the second reason weather is good to talk about is because whatever happens on the West Coast tends to drift east, given the rotational spin and the immutable fact that the winds travel in that direction, and usually what starts here happens there. Take a look at the psychosis in San Francisco, how it spread to the whole country. What began as a regional phenomenon of insanity has now permeated the entire society. Look at the people on MSNBC. So that's why I'm talking about life before air conditioning. That could be a new BC, life before air conditioning. It was a different world. I even went to a gym without air conditioning. Can you imagine working out in a gym? I would go from high school to the American L Studios underneath the elevated train on Jamaica Avenue. And work out. It was a religion. 4 days a week after school, you felt good. Your muscles were tight. You thought you could take on the world. And it was such an insecurity. You have no idea. I remember how I got deflated. I was 15 years old and working out. I was never big like some of the guys became, but I was hard as a rock. Even though I was on the wiry side, I was very strong from the working out. And I thought I was really great. And I remember in the summer, you'd strut around with those muscle shirts, the V shirts, they called them. To show how well-built you are. No different today. If a guy has a good body, shows it off. Why shouldn't he? Same with a girl. So this girl, I don't know her name was, Roberta. It was another Roberta, let's put it to you that way. Another Roberta, the transfusion tree in West Palm. Roberta said to me once, I remember we were showing off, the guys, I don't know how, she said, all weightlifters are insecure. I got so deflated. Now, I don't know whether she created a Klavan somewhere in Spokane afterwards, years later. Just knowing with a mouth like that, she couldn't have been married for too long if she ever got married at all. My suspicion is she wound up creating like a witchcraft, institution somewhere west of the Rocky Mountains. But actually, she was right. All weightlifters are insecure. Was right. She had wisdom. Most of the well-adjusted guys that, as it turns out, never went to the gym. They just went right into money, made money. All the other guys had to prove something. Now, it's true. They wrote books. They created music. They sculpted. They painted. They traveled the world. And they did it out of insecurity. They wanted to prove something. So what's wrong with that? That's the whole thing I'm trying to tell you. It's not bad to have insecurities. It motivates people. That's why it's good to give your children insecurities. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Don't build up their self-esteem. They'll wind up like you, worthless. They'll achieve nothing. They'll sit in the behinds because all that praise you gave them, what's the motivation? They have no guilt, no shame, no desire to prove anything. So they wind up doing nothing. They wait for the inheritance. You want your child to achieve? Berate them. You want your child to amount to something? Tell them they're nothing. You want your child to get 100? Tell them 98's not good enough. Now, of course, a little bit of this is a little bit, sarcastic or sardonic, whichever way you want to look at it. But the truth is, I have a friend, very wealthy man, who used to come home from school with 94s, 95s. His father was a horrendous taskmaster. He'd say to him, Dad, look, I got a 95. You know what's coming. He'd say, why didn't you get 100? He'd come home with a 98. Dad, look, I got a 98. Why didn't you get 100? To this day, the man is an achiever. A miserable, horrible human being. Never had a good day in his life. Not 2 minutes of peace in his life, but a phenomenal achiever and a wealthy man at that. So you have to add up what you want. You want to be a happy moron who achieves nothing and sits at home and rubs your stomach and waits for a check, either from inheritance or from the government? Go ahead. Or do you want to be miserable and prove things and build things and write things and build buildings? That's what you got to be. Guys who wind up building towers like the Taj Mahals with big wigs on and have good shrimp and good lettuce down in Palm Beach. That's what you want to become, to prove something. You don't want to sit around and do nothing with your life and be secure. It's like the high school guy who was a football player, let's say. Remember those guys you were jealous of? They looked like Tab Hunter. You look like Woody Allen or something to that effect. I'm giving you like the alpha and omega of looks. There are always kids in high school who were so good looking, you almost cried when you looked at them. There was no competing with them. It was like Archie and Jughead. You know what I'm saying? If you read those comics, there were kids that were so handsome. It was like movie star handsome. Usually they amounted to nothing. I don't understand it. I don't know that they never had long-lasting. It was the schlemiel kid who felt humiliated, the 98-pound weakling who got sand kicked in his face, who was so humiliated that he went out in life, and for the rest of his life he worked his behind off to prove something. That's the amazing thing of reality. It's unbelievable. How many of those good-looking guys ever amounted to anything? You'll tell me all of them that you knew, and the schlemiels wound up doing nothing. I can't make a generalized statement about the politics. I could jump. You take a look at some of the guys in politics. You compare them today. Take an example. John McCain was probably kind of like a typical good-looking high school guy on the dumb side, probably on a dummy side. Look at him today, spending $100 million to win a primary against the talk show host, J.D. Hayworth. It's amazing to me. I mean, I would support Hayworth, not McCain. McCain's a charlatan. But, you know, there's one thing you got to give McCain, his ability to change like a chameleon and make believe he's not changing, and his ability to keep fighting when long ago he lost the character race. But other than that, there's no reason to vote for him. Which leads me to the next thing I was going to say today, which is a good segue into that. There's a website out there that used to be conservative that became far left. It's called Newsmax. And I don't understand what happened to him. He's now catering to Bill Clinton. Now he comes out and supports John McCain. They become a Democrat website. So I was going to ask you, if a group like that at Newsmax has become Opportunist Max, what conservative opportunists in the media other than Newsmax have you seen turn to the left since Obama took office? And when did you first become disenchanted with these, either these websites or these talkers? Why do you suspect they turn to the left, play blowing in the wind as the cue code? Why do you suspect they turn to the left, play blowing in the wind? Why do you suspect these people turn to the left, these conservative opportunists, play blowing in the wind? That's the cue. I know. Oh, it's so slow, man. He's still around. Looks like my grandmother after like an anorexia attack.
The chance won't come again, and don't speak too soon, Father.
I always loved Bob Dylan. He's still performing it.
No,
I just want to hear this turn.
That it's naming.
This stanza, that's all.
For the loser now will to win for the time.
The loser now is the win. You're right, Bobby. Schmuck won. The schmucks turn out on top. The winners are all finished. They're either underground or... he was great even in his... He's still performing. He's like 70. How do they do this? How do they perform at that age? Look who's talking. I ran into a guy in the supermarket the other day. He said to me, Mike, he said, I love your show. I never thought he would have said that to me because it was a liberal supermarket. I was waiting in line for herring. It was unbelievable to go get herring here in liberal Marin County. I never go to markets. I have someone shop for me, but I reach the point where I want it because it's always wrong. If I ask for herring, it comes without juice in it. How could you eat herring without juice in it? Now, yes, why are you eating that? It's horrible. It is not horrible. Herring's a food very rich in omega-3 fatty acids. Yeah, you take the pills, but you also want to get the fish, right? So I eat herring. I eat anchovies. I eat sardines once in a while, whatever. But I happen to like herring on a bagel with tomato and avocado in the morning. I actually like that. With a cup of coffee and an orange juice. That's a typical breakfast. So I go to buy the herring, and the wait in this deli was beyond belief. First, I had to go through three non-English speakers. Now, have you tried to tell somebody from Mongolia in a white uniform with like an A&W hat on in a supermarket what herring is? Go try to explain it to someone from Mongolia. I mean, God bless her. I'm an immigrant son, but it's enough already with the English as a third language. I asked the woman, I said, where do you have herring? She gave me a look. I didn't know what she... Herring, all right, thank you. So finally someone in line said, there's the herring, like an English speaker. The only English speakers in there were the customers. Oh, did I tell you the funny thing that happened in there? This, you got to hear this one. I'm in the supermarket waiting for the herring. Went on forever with the number. And I never saw a sandwich. It had five people with white hats on, six people making sandwiches. This is on a lazy Sunday. But I got to tell you something, out of town is a sort of torture. I've lived out of town so long, it's become normal. But at this point, it's reaching a critical mass. Remember, I grew up in New York where one deli man in one appetizing store on Long Island could serve 43 people in about 14 minutes. He could multitask. He was cutting a tongue sandwich. He was measuring the salami. He did so many things at once, and you were out of there in 5 minutes. No one had patience. That's how I grew up. Now you got six people with the root beer hats on. And they're making a sandwich, and you, why, would you like pickles on it? Yeah, and a little mayo. And it's like glue drying. Till he makes the sandwich, my hands are clenching. The foot is in the shoe, in and out. I don't say, how can you say anything? You know, you move faster than them. What does that make them, a criminal? No. So I'm standing there. So a big Italian guy with a booming voice on him. The guy was maybe 6'7". He was an older man. But he had a voice on him. When he talked low, the room like rumbled in a supermarket. The guy was a born actor. Maybe he is. You remember some of the characters in some of the early like gangster movies? There's one guy, I wish I knew his name. Of all of the Italian character actors, this guy was the best. He was in a movie. Wait, hold it. Someone's going to pick the name up. I know I got a listener in New York who's going to know. He'll tell me, yeah, it's my brother-in-law, Sal. It was the movie Prince of the City, number one. I forget the main actor in it. Prince of the City was good at that time. Then he started playing like... Light in the Shoe roles. Who was the guy who played in Prince in the City? I want to see if I'm even listening. The lights are a little dim right now. Who's listening? They want me to say, the mosque is no damn good. I'm telling you, end that mosque. I'm not going to do politics right now. I'm going to go back to the reminiscence and the deli. Does anyone know who the Italian actor is in Prince of the City that I'm talking about? The big guy who got into a ruckus and they threw him through a plate glass window. He was about 6. Anyway, this guy was like him. 6'6", maybe 325 pounds. So he's standing in the deli. Wait a minute. He also is waiting for a sandwich. Good-natured guy. And a pockmarked face, even though you saw he had bad acne as a youth, which made him even meaner as a kid. But now he's like an ever benevolent 65-year-old guy. Doesn't bother anybody. Looks like. So he's standing there in the middle of nowhere on a Sunday. And he makes a remark, to the deli guy, but everyone heard it, with a rumbling voice. A booming, rumbling voice. He says, oh, I grew up in the New York... blah, 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 a sandwich, something like that, something nice. So the deli woman says to him, just matter-of-factly, she said, well, you must have grown up in a nice Italian neighborhood. She was trying to, he says, no, not so nice. Well, everyone breaks out laughing on the deli line, which is very funny. And it went from there, some people have a natural sense of humor. He says, no, not so nice. And I don't know, one word led to the other. It was a very nice moment. the sandwich, Tilly got through with her, about 15 minutes till she made him his sandwich. And would you like a provolone, you know, another, some, the machine, another one, a slice. And they pick up in the hand and move in the, next. It's like a bad, it's like a nightmare. It's like a diet went to like deli hell. Like, when is it, Sam? When can, and all I wanted was like a quarter of a pound of herring. I was embarrassed, by the way. So I bought other things that I didn't need. I threw them out. I was embarrassed just to buy herring. I waited so long. In other words, I made such an investment in time for the herring, I figured I'd buy other things. I took them home. I puked from one of them. It was horrible. Why do they put fennel on salads here in San Francisco? They made a thing with, I love artichokes. They did something with cooked artichokes with some, and with fennel on it. It was so, anise. I have never tasted a spice that does not belong on food like anise. Why call that an Italian salad? The only people who ate anise or fennel in Italy were those who were starving to death under Mussolini. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Well, we'll do the whole deal a little later. You know, my website, michaelsavage.com, there's a lot of stories there, so you can, your brain hurts from them. So I figured today we move in a little another a little bit, because my, it's so hot, my mind is bubbling over with joyous interludes of my own, you know, making in my own head. It's entertaining me. I remember when I was starting to write, there were idiots who never amounted to anything who would say things like, well, you only write for your own pleasure. They read stuff like, you're supposed to only write for your own pleasure. Yeah, go try to sell that. Write for your own pleasure, idiot. You got to write for an audience, schmuck. Robert in New York, WOR. Go ahead, you're on the air. What's on your mind, Robert?
A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about what type of artist I thought you were. And I said an expressionist, a realist. And getting thought up in the Adirondacks for a week, I think that really you are a verbal Dadaist.
Dada, dada, mama. What do you mean, Dadaist?
Well, Dadaist, by, in fact, just like the story you were just telling about the Italian deli, or a story you once told about being in the line at Starbucks, where you can just take a commonplace event and turn it into art in your story.
Well, okay, but I understand that. But when Van Gogh painted the potato eaters, that didn't make him a Dadaist, did it?
No, the Dadaists were more tongue-in-cheek.
Ah. Like,
Marcel Duchamp, Man Ray, you know, taking the urinal, E. Mont, writing a name on it, hanging it on the wall.
Okay, I get it. Yeah, when I get into Man in the Street stuff, I could see it's all crazy out there. In other words, it is like the ticket that exploded. It's like William Burroughs, the ticket that exploded. The whole world is like the ticket that exploded, isn't it?
Well, I think William Burroughs is a good point. You know, yes, it's the Beats more than the hippies.
Well, now we're already bordering on a dangerous terrain, because I knew some of the Beats. They were the most terrible people I ever met on the planet. None of them were straight up. None of them were any good. All right, but you're saying, it's like me. You know, when I went out the other night in L.A. with a couple of good people, I said to them, I don't even care what a person's politics are. If they entertain me, I'll watch their movie. I actually take that back. The other night, I was sitting and watching some movie. I was passing, and it was Robert De Niro. I usually like anything he does, even though he's a lefty. I don't care. But there was a scene where Sean Penn appeared in it. I got nauseous and turned it off. I won't even watch anything with Sean Penn in it anymore. He's such an America hater. I can't watch the man.
Well, I can understand why.
See, so now I'm going from Dadaist to realist, right?
Well, Dadaist, yes, to realist.
So what do you do up in the Adirondacks? What kind of art?
I'm a painter. You know, we talked about, I do sort of abstract work.
Let me get into, like, imagine. I don't know you. Da, da, da. So you're up there. You got a house near the lake. You got pine cones, a screened-in porch, or what?
Cabin, little cabin on the lake, right? My wife go up there, and we write. We write a newsletter, part of it around the country.
And, but what do you do, like, when you get bored? I mean, you don't go anywhere? I mean, there's nothing, like, you can't even get a coffee in there.
I don't get bored. I always have something.
You're a very lucky man, because I've thought about, you know, the rustic life. Even from the time I was young, I always thought I'd end up in the Adirondacks, strangely enough. You know, originally, I didn't want that much out of life. I thought I would teach high school. I'd retire. I would have a little house on a lake. I used to love the lakes up there. I'd never like the isolation that long. You know what it is? It ruined. What ruined me is the years I spent in the South Pacific Islands alone collecting plants. I couldn't take the After that, isolation became my enemy. Now, it doesn't mean that I cannot take solitude. Solitude is different than isolation, Robert. Am I correct about that?
Yes. Yes.
You see, people don't understand the difference between the nuances between solitude and isolation. Solitude is one thing. I like to work alone. I like to do my show alone. But isolation is another story. When you get into an isolated location, as I was on islands, all alone, hardly speaking the Fijian language, as nice as the Fijians were, I felt as though I had landed on the moon and I was trying to communicate with another species of people. I was strange to them. They were strange to me. And as beautiful as they were, it was very, very alienating, frankly.
I couldn't live in the Adirondacks all year long.
Oh, now you're going to say you have a private jet and you fly to Aruba whenever you want.
No, I get in my car and drive back down to Beacon, New York, you know. I mean, but it's...
To each his own. I got to read this list of names. I'm looking up Prince of the City, Treat Williams, when he was still a good actor. But then there's weird names in there. Joe Marinaro was played by Richard Fornaggi. Gino Moscone was played by Carmine Caridi. Rick Capellino played Norman Parker. That couldn't have been him. Who played, I don't know, Santamassino was played by Bob Balaban. And then there's Ronnie Chiello, couldn't have been. Who was the big guy in Prince of the City? The big guy got thrown through a plate glass window. I think I met him in the deli the other day is the point.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Days of summer, August in San Francisco, 101 degrees. Woof, unexpected. I mean, I love to boast about my cold city. Wow, but there's a plus to everything. So the economy is the real issue. Hindenburg Omen creator exits stock market. People are predicting. I got an email from a good friend of mine, and he's in the gold. A double dip for depression, and then the dollar is worthless, and the whole West is shot. There's no currencies on earth that are worth anything. So I said, don't worry, I got my wheelbarrow ready. I mean, he got the joke. What do I mean when I say I got my wheelbarrow ready? The famous picture, the Weimar Republic, where a human had to take a wheelbarrow filled with paper currency to buy a loaf of bread. A nightmare, if that should happen. But when you got a president as clueless as we have, an incompetent who was shoehorned into the position by moneyed interests who wanted to bust out the economy for their own interests, for their own reasons, for their own power grab, we have real trouble. We have an imperious president. We have an imperious first lady. She goes to Spain and dines with the king. People are on bread lines here. Now they're on Martha's Vineyard at a $50,000 a week rental. You hear this? And he's playing night basketball because it's raining. That's what he's doing. And they don't show any pictures of him because you're liable to get upset and put two and three together and come up with 16. We don't know what's coming. But my book, Trickle Up Poverty, will be out in October. And although I think the title is so good that it's going to go to the top of the charts right off the bat, I know that. It may not be such a trickle-up poverty. Actually, it could be a little on the run-up poverty. Not a trickle. It could be a flood-up poverty altogether that's coming. But the book describes all of what's happening. I mean, I even describe who did it to you. None of them have been indicted. None of them are in jail. All of them are allowed to visit England to get the dental work and the cuisine that they are entitled to. I only wish they went to England for the dental work that they should have. The person I personally like to send to England for dental work would be the head of the Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan. I'd like to see him go get dental work and stay there for the rest of his life dining on British cuisine. How could there be a 60-mile traffic jam? I mean, it gives me a better feeling about their military capacity. Because if they were to try to run trucks to, let's say, a port to ship out material and men, God only knows they'll level up a 60-mile traffic jam on the way to the docks. If only the 60 miles, they'd be even happier by the former head of the DNC, the largest single donor to the Bill Clinton regime. The man who started with the parking meter company in the Bronx, and I wound up in the missile business, got the technology from the Defense Department and shared it with the communist Chinese, probably on Martha's Vineyard. Bono and Medvedev are having tea? What in the hell? Why do the world leaders have anything to say to that putz? What the hell does Bono have to tell Medvedev? What does that schmuck? He's just a stooge, a useful moron. What does Bono know, the putz with the glasses? I don't understand this. Full body scan. Full body scan. I had one. I almost had a full body. I had a pat down from a gangbanger. I told you that already yesterday. At the John Wayne Airport. No, it was at Oakland. At Oakland, I got the gangbanger pat down. In the crotch, in the armpit. Turn around, sir. That's because the other third worlder who screened me at I don't even feel like it's my country. Ticket. I feel like I was entering Mongolia. Then I go through security, and the next thing you know, I was called aside for some reason. A little flight to L.A., and the gangbanger comes out and wants me with his hands in the crotch, in the arm, in the neck. The belt is off, the pants are off, the shoes are off. I love traveling. There's nothing like it. I love it. I got a letter the other day from a listener. You may have heard her the other day. She called from Oregon. And she was so adamantly excited about the Muslim question and the danger that we are in because of the imam, because of the Ground Zero Mosque, that I asked her to call in a letter she wrote me, and I'm going to play a piece of it for you right now. Listen to this.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on the air. I really appreciate you having me read my opinion. I feel that I have a lot to say about what's going on in the world today and in America. So here we go. Americans' tax dollars are going to help fund a trip for Imam Rauf for the purposes of some kind of religious outreach project. Let me get this straight. Our government is helping to fund the religious outreach of Islam. Really? Pure convolution. Firstly, why does the current administration care about the outreach of the Muslim religion? Since when has it become America's job or responsibility to support, let alone further, Islam? The whole idea of the outreach itself is utterly hypocritical. This administration is becoming increasingly intolerant of its founding religion, as Christianity is under attack daily. It could be said that the current leftist Muslim government in America is doing the opposite here on our own soil, attempting to inhibit the practice of Christianity at every turn. This country stands because of Christianity. Our very laws and constitution were born out of the heart and spirit of this religion. Its very nature permeates this country. Every American feels it and benefits from it, whether they prescribe to it or not. And people all over the world come here for it. There is not another country in the world or that has ever existed that has offered such freedom. Now let's consider Sharia law. It is born out of the heart and spirit of the Muslim religion. Sharia law is diametrically opposed to the very laws that founded and govern America. The two cannot coexist equally. Only one can rule. The other must capitulate. One will lead and one will follow. That is why Sharia law must never be allowed, let alone honored, anywhere in the United States of America. Its abusive practices and its perpetrators should be tried under American laws just as any other American citizen would be. The very nature of Sharia subverts our way of life and the founding principles of this country and must never be given the lead. At one time in America's history, this clashing of religious practice versus American law existed with the Mormon religion. Their practice of plural marriage came up against the laws of the United States. Because of this, the Mormon religion changed their course. One man, one wife. The Mormon religion became better for it, embodying the epitome of the American family and family values. America actually helped make this religion what it is today. This similar but much more diabolical clash is here today with the practices of the Muslim religion, and America must make the same stance with them. Many of their practices are illegal under our laws. Are we going to stand by this time and let them by, give them a place in our society, thereby undermining it? If we do, it is our course that will change. They will be the ruler and we the compliant. This would be fundamental transformation at its core. Now, if we stand steadfast to our founding principles, it will be Islam that will have to submit. Their course will have to change. America may then have a positive effect on this religion also. Americans must understand that Sharia law and America's laws cannot coexist. They are based on opposing fundamental beliefs. Sharia on Islamic beliefs, America on Christian beliefs.
Savage. Well, that was a very heartfelt, very, very brilliant and insightful letter from a listener. I rarely invite a listener to call in and be recorded, but I felt that Patricia was so right on the money that, and I think she spoke for so many listeners who don't get to express themselves. She's very concerned about the imposition of some of the diabolical practices that we are witnessing, female circumcision, for example, multiple marriage, to name a few, that something has to be said, and no one's saying it. Our leaders aren't saying it because they're not our leaders. And there's an old phrase from the 70s, when the leaders won't lead the people, when the leaders won't lead the people must lead the leaders, which was used to be a thing that the liberals knew about. But it's time for us to lead the leaders because they're worthless. So enough of that. Back to what's going on in the real world. And what the real world is a terrible place. It is like a ticket that exploded. As I said earlier, it's almost like that William Burroughs title. America's become like the ticket that exploded. We have an imposterous president who's on Martha's Vineyard with the first lady who lectures us on health foods and dieting and eats ice cream. Every time we see her, she's got another ice cream cone in her mouth. And we got a president who preaches austerity and leases a $50,000 a week vacation cottage while the average American is struggling to make payments on their car, let alone the house, which they probably lost last year. So where do we turn? Some say that the economy is bad, but it's going to get much worse. People are terrified that the market is going to go down. Now, I'm no expert on the stock market. I frankly don't have any stocks. But I was going to ask you today in a business segment, do you still believe in the stock market? Have you changed your investment strategy and why? What is it that you're investing in? I mean, many people have cash and they're sitting on T-bills. A lot of people I know who have cash are sitting on T-bills, which are zero interest T-bills. How long can this go on with trillions of dollars, excuse me, in treasuries that are paying zero interest? This is number one. Number two, I've never heard of a government arbitrarily holding down an economy where it pays no interest. This makes no sense to me. Even as an amateur economist, which all of us are, incidentally, you follow what I'm saying? We're all amateur economists. If we're balancing a checkbook, we're an amateur economist. But in many ways, we amateurs know more about the economy than professionals like Alan Greenspan, who permitted the jury riggers to wreck the entire system. All the experts did was create false fiduciary instruments built on a house of cards, which fundamentally was a Ponzi scheme. We, the amateurs, on the other hand, have to pay the checks every month, and we do. So are we really that much of an amateur when we say, how could interest be zero? Why should interest be zero? Why is our government holding the interest rate at zero? Well, the answer is because they're afraid of starting an inflationary trend. My friends, every economist I've read who's worth anything predicts a great inflationary trend is on the horizon. Every one of them. They say first we're going to have a real depression and then an inflation to follow it. Now, I don't quite know the extent of which of these peaks and valleys is going to hit first, rather how deeply it's going to hit, nor when they're going to hit. Nobody knows that. But the fact of the matter is some of the big naysayers are leaving the stock. There's a guy who wrote the Hindenburg Omen. Now, whoever that is, the Hindenburg Omen is a technical indicator which uses a plethora of data to foreshadow a stock market crash, and it was tripped again on Friday, marking the second time since August 12th that it has occurred. It also came very close on Thursday. And the latest trigger has prompted the Omen's creator, Jim Mika, to get out of the market. He said this. By the way, Mika is a blind mathematician. He said, I'm taking it seriously, and I'm fully out of the market now. He said, I would have probably stayed in until the beginning of September, depending on how the indicators varied. That was my basic plan until the Hindenburg came along. This is pretty interesting. So what is the Hindenburg omen? Apparently, it's been behind every market crash since 1987. But significant stock market declines have followed only 25% of the time. So let's not panic. There's a high likelihood in this that this so-called omen could be nothing more than a false signal. But many people believe in it. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is nothing but the original Savage Nation. We're talking about so many different topics right now that I'm going to introduce another one in order to purposely confuse you and to stupefy you into responding by calling 1-800-449-8255 or going to michaelsavage.com. Let's take a caller first in Portland, Oregon. Jay, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thanks so much for taking my call, Doctor. I've been listening a long time, got a couple of your books. And I'm intrigued by your new title for Trickle Up Poverty. I wonder what inspired you for that title, if you could share that with me.
Well, tell me what's going on in our society if not Trickle Up Poverty. Is Obama not causing poverty to go up the society?
I agree.
You remember under, who was it who gave us the trickle-down economy? Was it Ronald Reagan, remember?
It was Reagan
who said we have a trickle-down economy, meaning if he helps people on the top by freeing them up with lower taxes, less red tape, they will invest in business will boom, there'll be more jobs and more spending, and you'll have money trickling down. They call it a trickle down economy. Obama is doing the reverse. By ensnaring people with higher taxes and more red tape, he's killing business, reducing jobs, reducing spending, and causing poverty to go up and up and up. It's trickling up. That's the whole theory of the book. But wait, you asked me, so I'll tell you the rest of it. Obama and his policies are not just impoverishing us economically. Obama and his policies are impoverishing the society on virtually every level, whether it be on education, military, NASA. Every societal aspect of our country is being impoverished by Obama's naked Marxism, in my humble opinion, and I set out to prove it, not just to say it. I offer hard proof, Jay. And so you know what? Since you permitted me to pontificate on my book, I'm going to send you a free copy when it is out in October. All you got to do is stay on the line. We'll take down your name, and I will send you a copy. It can only be ordered in advance now on Amazon.com. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. We got great callers. New York, Mark, go ahead, please, on the economic issue. What are you investing in these days, Mark?
I personally am in the diamond business, and I know you're a big advocate of gold, but when it comes to crisis, you can't really carry more than $25,000 worth. So I personally...
Let me ask you something. Let's say the economy really goes bad and the dollar becomes worthless because of hyperinflation or something to that effect. You're saying that through time, diamonds and precious stones will retain their value? Is that what you're saying?
Let me give you a good example, because we are Jewish. In the time of the Holocaust, most people had to swallow their diamonds, and that helped them when coming to America.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know what I never understood, and this is something I'm not saying with any degree of sarcasm. How do you get through a border crossing with diamonds or gold when the guy could just kill you and take it all? I don't understand that part of it.
Savage.
You know, there's a big scandal, or let's say controversy, a better word, about Obama. Is he a Muslim? 25% of Americans or 20% think he's a Muslim. So the elites are shocked where they get that idea. They really praise in secret Although he doesn't go to church, he's not seen it, he's a humble man. He goes into the back in the Camp David, there's a certain chapel, a revolving door, so no one should see him. His religion is so deeply Christian that he doesn't even want to show it. He prays alone on the constant, and then they wheel out a spiritual advisor who tells anyone who thinks he's a Muslim, because his middle name is Hussein and his father was a Muslim and his stepfather was a Muslim, anyone who comes to the conclusion, therefore, that he's a Muslim, even though by Muslim law he's a Muslim, anyone who thinks that is a racist, a bigot, a right-wing maniac, and immediately should be investigated by Nancy Pelosi's friends in high places, because there's no question that if you even question whether or not he's a devout Christian, you're absolutely a turncoat to the American way and should be put into the American Legion cooking pot and turned into a sausage run by Nancy Pelosi's ravioli factory. Well, here's the question about the truth about Obama's Muslim faith. If he is such a Christian, why does he need a spiritual advisor who doesn't even look like a Christian to me? Whoever heard of a spiritual advisor to come on television who's really just a PR man pushing the myth that he's very, very devoutly Christian? I don't know what his faith is, nor do I really care what his faith is, to be frank with you. I have long said I don't care what a person's sexuality is. Actually, I don't. And I don't care what a person's religion is at the end of the day. I might be curious in the beginning, but at the end of the day, I don't really care. I think a person's religion is their own business. I don't really want it. I don't like people who wear their religion on their sleeve. To me, it's a very personal thing. It's not really for public consumption. And so when it was made into an issue during the campaign, for example, when Romney came along, right away the left-wing vermin who are now supporting Obama saying he's not a Muslim, how dare you even suggest it, and the imam's a wonderful guy, even though he is a Muslim, the marimah, the minute a Mormon came along, they turned him into Hitler. Now explain to me why the radicals in the media have such a distaste for anyone who's a Christian of any kind to begin with, but more specifically why they hate Mormons and why they're so in love with Islam and Muslims, I'll never understand. Other than an insanity, liberalism is a mental disorder. There's no other explanation. And I define them as Christophobes. A long time ago, I used the term Christophobic. So the next time one of your liberal brethren throw the word at you, are you an Islamophobe, say to them, you a Christophobe. That's all. End of discussion. Mirror them. Hold a cross up to the vampire of lies. That's all. End of story. Let's go on. Don't talk about it, because there's nothing more to be said. We're living in a very dangerous time. We have a man as president who was never, never, ever qualified for this position. If only McCain had listened to me when I gave him the one line that could have sank Obama during the last debate. All right, so I'll have a best-selling book from it called Trickle Up Poverty in October. There's always a silver lining. I was banned in Britain. I spent about $400,000 so far trying to get my name off the list to no avail. But there's a silver lining. I didn't have to go there for dental work. And I didn't have to eat fish and chips in Piccadilly Square. So there's always a positive to the negative. But when you come into the truth about Obama's Muslim faith, and you ask yourself, where did his mojo go, so to speak, to put it in popular parlance, the answer is it went by the way of the myth that was surrounding him when the entrepreneurs who created him put him in office to begin with, and now the mojo's gone, so they're working on the next puppet. On Martha's Vineyard, by the way. Where not only are the grapes of wrath stored, but they're creating a new vintage for you to drink come September. They'll have a whole new bottle of wine made from the grapes of wrath that you'll have to be drinking, believe me, for the rest of your life. And I'm not making it up. I'm telling you exactly what's going on. Why does he go to Martha's Vineyard? Of all places to go, a worse public relations choice he could not have made. He couldn't have made a worse choice in his life. Martha's Vineyard is known to be the place where all the bankers who screwed us congregate in August. Why is he there? Because they put him in power. He didn't go there to play night basketball in the rain. He went there to hear what they had to say, so he'll know what to say when he comes back, so he doesn't go too far off course from where they want him to go between now and November, and moreover, now between now and 2012. And for those of you who think that the Democrats are automatically out of office come November, I have a second guess for you. And for those of you who think that Obama's not going to be a second-term president, I have another guess for you. Take another guess. The Republicans are so incompetent. The Republicans are nothing but Democrat light. They stand for nothing, and they're going to lose. You may think they're going to win, but there are millions and millions of people who do not want to vote Republican. Okay, so they have a third-party candidate. And what party is that candidate running in? Tell me. All they're going to do is split the vote on the conservative side and put these thieves and criminals back in power. And that's the state of the world, the ticket that exploded. Now I'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. We can talk about something as profoundly mundane as what are you investing in today? Kathy in New York, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
I don't mean to bore you, but I was in the market. I'm just a housewife. I used to work in banking, and I saw all these hot shots that I worked for, and they were always talking about their stocks and whether they're going to merge. And I came to realize after two times this stuff went south that we're just all floating around in a game we can't possibly even know the rules. And
right.
It's just like playing that game when we used to play Risk. The rules would be there, and you could read them, and somebody could win or lose.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and you're right, and I don't want to interrupt you, but you were breaking up. You're saying don't play a rigged market because you really can't win. Well, I'll leave that up to the individual. I had a friend as a kid whose father was a professional gambler. It's an unusual lifestyle, I admit, and probably even more unusual from the milieu in which I grew up, but he was a professional gambler. I told you about this man several times. All the boys looked up to him because he was a man's man. He was the toughest guy in the neighborhood. He was a fist fighter, a street fighter, a gentleman, as quiet as they came, never raised his voice to his children or to his wife, but a kind of genuinely strong, tough John Wayne type, who also happened to be a professional gambler. And as we grew up, he would take us aside. He'd lecture the boys. He'd give us speeches. Not lecture, really, but we kind of hung on his every word. And he would say to us, you know, guys, don't go to the racetrack. It's a fool's game. You don't understand. The whole thing is rigged. You can't win. And he would tell us, oh, because we were all getting into the racetrack. I remember to this. I don't even remember that phase of my life till this second. I used to go up to the Trotters, the Yonkers Raceway. What excitement. The money, the betting, in fact, it was all coming back to me now. The tickets on the floor, you talk about the tickets that exploded. But I loved it for a certain phase of my life. And then we got heavily into it, even as college kids, we were all going up there. And he was telling us, don't go to the track, it's all rigged, you can't win. So is the stock market any different than a racetrack? I don't really know. Some can survive in it, some can thrive in it. There was a day when you could get blue chip stocks and you always made a percentage point every year, a few points, and you knew you were going to leave something for your children. Those days, I think, are largely over. The smart guys who manipulate the stocks will always know what to do, and until the end of the game when they don't know what to do. And then they'll be walking around with a barrel around their pants with suspenders selling pencils in the street, like happened during the Depression. You think it can't happen here? It has happened here. It could happen again. Right now, who knows how long the genies are going to be able to keep us from the inevitable coming to a Jesus meeting that we're all going to have. Because right now we all know that we're living on fake money, currency that has no value. Once we went off the gold standard, which, by the way, Richard Nixon did. Incidentally, many of you don't know, Mr. Republican Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard. That has to be written about at a certain point in order for you to understand them. When you say commie is socialist that. At a certain end of the day, you got to understand there's no difference between the Republican, the Democrat, the Republican. There's an economy, and then they have advisors, and then they have people who put the advisors in power to begin with, and they want certain things done a certain way, and it's usually driven by bottom-line considerations, as you well know. So if it means sending factories to Malaysia, then to China, that's what happened. It goes back to the 1970s. I was at that time living in Hawaii. I was going to graduate school, early 70s. And I remember seeing Japanese tourists pouring into Honolulu. And the strangest thing was that they would all ride around on buses that they shipped over from Japan for the tourists to ride on. They wouldn't even ride on Greyhound buses or American-made buses. They shipped their own buses over to make sure that not a dollar from the Japanese tourists, as few dollars as possible, seeped into the American economy. So even though I was a young guy at the time, I said, this picture is wrong. It's our country. They lost the war. So I was thinking, if we had any leaders, they would put a crackdown on this. They would say, no, you can't ship your buses over. You're going to ride around in our tour buses in order to build up our economy. But that never happened. It got worse, far worse. Then you look around. I love to watch 1970s movies at night. One of the things I love about 1970s movies, especially movies set in Manhattan or in a city in America, I like seeing the streets. They're all American cars. You ever watch this? Every car that you see in a 1970s movie is an American car, without exception. I mean, okay, one, you'll see one of Mercedes here and there. Every car, 99% of the cars, are American cars on the streets. Do you remember the early Clint Eastwood movies? Now, what happened to this country that few American cars are ever seen on the streets anymore? Who did this to us? How did this happen? Why is it not reversed? Why is there no tariff put on foreign cars? I've been asking this for 15 years. You say, well, if we put a tariff on Japanese-made products and cars, the worst thing might happen is we might have an industry back again. Can't have that. After all, the gangsters who make all of their money by screwing us might have to work for a living, you see? So you can't ask for a thing like that to put an actual tariff, for example, on a Japanese car or Chinese-made goods. You could slap a tariff on Chinese-made goods tomorrow. You could put a 20% tariff on everything that comes from China. A lot of things would happen immediately. You could say, well, it'd be counter. The free marketeers argue that tariffs are bad because once you start a trade war. And what happens is then the Chinese put tariffs on your goods, and before long, everyone suffers. That would be true if there was truly a free market economy. But it is no longer a free market economy. And so, therefore, there's an argument to be made for protectionism. And in that regard, I say there's a good argument to be made for to put tariffs on Chinese goods and on other goods. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Oh, God, is Obama a Muslim? Why did he come out for the mosque when he didn't have to? Why did he step into that when people are asking? The answer is because he actually believes it's a good idea to put a mosque on Ground Zero. Then he said the next day he didn't say he really meant it. He's only saying in principle he would mean it if he wasn't afraid to say he actually meant it, and that you come to the conclusion that he was actually on the side of those who wanted to build a mosque on Ground Zero. So therefore, he's totally neutral, and I'm leaving for night basketball, so don't ask any other questions. Because I and the family are going to be busy sampling ice cream in Martha's Vineyard in the midst of the rain. So there it is. Now that Obama has decided to be for the Ground Zero Mosque, people are asking, again, 20% of Americans say that he's a Muslim. I would say, so what? And, you know, actually the proper answer now for Obama, I know this is going to shock you, would be for him to come out of the headscarf, so to speak, come out from behind the headscarf and just say, you know, in a way, I do have faith in Islam. My father was Muslim, and I'm very proud of it. And although my mother was Christian, I consider myself a child of both faiths. What would be wrong with that? But he won't say that. This is a product of the country being naive, or the people couldn't accept it? I really don't know, but I mean, I would do that if I were him. Since it's an issue, you deal with the issue that way. But he doesn't have people who are advising him correctly with regard to PR or with regard to with the economy. I try to advise McCain. They wrote me off, and McCain lost. I actually would advise Obama to just already cut it out and talk about it in a positive manner. I mean, there are aspects of Islam that are realistically decent. I mean, let's not get carried away here and wipe away a whole religion because of a whole generation of fanatics that arose out of Saudi Arabia based upon 18th century teachings. I mean, there was a period of time that Islam was a rather a sympathetic religion with others, and all he has to do is go along with that. Even the chairman of Al Arabiya came out last week and said that it would be a victory mosque and a terrible idea, because he's an educated man who happens to be of the Muslim faith. I mean, there are such individuals. There are people who are to Islam what many of you are to Christianity. You are putatively a Christian, you are born a Christian, you live a Christian, you wear a cross, and you'll die a Christian, but truthfully, it doesn't mean that much to you. Many of you are like that. I think most, you say, well, there are, yeah, of course there are those who are fanatically involved with religion. I understand that, whether it be Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Judaism, or Hinduism. I understand it. But the majority of people, for them, the faith is not that strong. It's more of a cultural identity than it is a religious identity. That's the way of the world today. In fact, it's probably the salvation for humanity. To stop more wars, but okay, let's not go down that road. That's not denigrating those who are religiously devout, okay? At the same time, I believe that as well. But on the other hand, what would be wrong for Obama to say, my father was a Muslim, I can see why many people would think, because my middle name is Hussein, that I share Muslim and Christian identities in that regard, and I think they're both beautiful religions, and we all have a unified struggle against the radicals in the Muslim world. He could do both at the same time. He could clear the air once and for all and stop walking the fence and making people so anguished. But okay, I'm not a politician. I'm a talk radio host, unknown man. No one knows me. You know, it's true. I've had many bestsellers, but I'm not known. I'm certainly not known. I'm not allowed on Fox News, so therefore I don't exist. I certainly wouldn't be allowed into the elite denizens of ABC, CBS, or NBC where the elites go. No, I wouldn't be allowed on shows like that because, after all, anyone who appears on that show has a book that doesn't sell at all. I mean, take a look at Nancy Pelosi. She sold 4,000 copies of her book, all of which probably was sold north of Market Street to her cronies. But if she was on every network show, what does it matter? What does it matter? What I'm saying to you is he could come out and he could do a very Solomon-esque answer to this Muslim question and come out the better for it. But who am I to advise him? They probably wouldn't listen to me if they ever heard me at all. And they're all basically in disarray right now. I don't know what they're going to do next, but they're not going to do the right thing either for him and his identity question or for the economy and the economic questions that we're all asking today. Chicago, Tom, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Michael, the reason I think so many people think he's a Muslim, and I'm surprised it's not higher, is based on his own actions. It's really his own fault that people think that, because when he went to Turkey last year, he went to a madrasa and he assumed the Muslim prayer position. I've never seen any president before him do anything like that.
Well, okay, so as I said, let's say he is a Muslim, but let's say he's not a fanatic, he's not Al-Qaeda, for God's sakes, let's not get carried away. He's probably a Muslim as much as most Americans are Christian, is my position.
Right, I'd have no problem with it. I agree with you.
See? Well, that's what I'm trying to get across. I hope people write this down. You should mark down what I just said. I'd rather he came out and said I could see the confusion, but in fact, I do share many attributes of, I do accept many attributes of the Muslim faith. My father was Muslim, but my mother was Christian. And we all have a common enemy, which is the radical Islamist, which is why we're at war in Afghanistan. His popularity would soar, but he'll never do that because advisors to politicians are notoriously thick. They are notoriously cowardly and thick. And they also underestimate the people, incidentally, at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. They think that we're all a bunch of dummies out here.
Yeah, they all think that we don't understand things and we can't follow things and we need to be spoken to like we're a bunch of dumb children. They're wrong about that. So to call him a Muslim is not the issue. The issue is, what do you mean by Muslim? What is it like saying you're a Christian? Is it a dirty word to say you're a Christian? And you know, it's not a dirty word to say you're Jewish. Is that a dirty word? Oh, you're Jewish. What does that mean? I don't know what it means. It means what you want it to mean. You're a certain religion. You're born of a certain religion, or you follow certain precepts to a certain extent. The same thing with other religions. It's a matter of where you are politically with regard to that religion. And by the way, let's turn it around. You want to really clear the air? Take politicians who are of the Jewish faith, whether they are actively such as Lieberman is allegedly an Orthodox practitioner, or let's say on the complete opposite side of the scale, someone as deranged as Barney Frank on the opposite end, who just uses his Judaism as a weapon, in my opinion. So does that mean they can't make any statements with regard to issues regard to the Middle East? I don't know. Some people would say, how dare they even talk about Israel since they're Jewish? That's absurd, since you have people who are Jewish who hate Israel, and then you have people who are Jewish who worship the state of Israel. So just saying you're a Jewish doesn't mean anything politically. You have to understand where they're coming from. Same with a Muslim. So you say, you're a Muslim. Well, what does that mean? It means you have to know where they are politically. And you'd have to understand what I just said by that. Don't assume every Muslim is a boogeyman, is the point I'm making. Now, having said that, we know that the imam for the Ground Zero Mosque is, in fact, a boogeyman. This man has said things that are shocking, that should disqualify him from public discourse after this. Okay? So you see, there are varieties and extremes within every religion. Right now, that's all we should be talking about, not the religion itself.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Now listen up.
what complicates the discussion intra-Islamically is the fact that the West has not been cognizant and has not addressed the issues of its own contribution to much injustice in the Arab and Muslim world. It's a difficult subject to discuss with Western audiences, but it's one that must be pointed out and must be raised.
And evermore, I'm just a fool, a fool in love with you.
You know, the sound today is very interesting. The imam behind the Ground Zero Mosque, who has been sold to us as a moderate Muslim, it turns out that he gave a lecture in July of 05 attacking America, saying the U.S. Is worse than Al-Qaeda, which is a total lie. And so therefore he is a stealth Islamist, in my opinion. He even justifies, he seems to justify terrorism. He says the historians have said that terrorism has been used since the beginning of time, since the Romans. And terrorism, he says, was designed to achieve very specific political targets. And at the time, he said, whoever is behind the bombings in London and Madrid, of course, they were Islamists. He said, whoever's behind it, we can see there were targeted political objectives, almost justifying it. Isn't it interesting to see how our State Department is so friendly to Imam Rauf of the Ground Zero Mosque, and how you foolish liberals have taken the bait, hook, line, and sinker that this is about freedom of religion? You are the useful idiots Karl Marx talked about. You're also the future slaves of America. Without us conservatives, God only knows what would happen to this country. We then have amateur video shot in New York that your local station will not show, revealing that the pro-mosque protesters hate Jews, screaming that Hitler was right, screaming to get the oven started, over and over and over again. Pro-mosque supporter hits the reporter's camera. It goes on and on. It's astounding. You've got to see this. You got to hear it. It's all on Michael Savage today. We then covered Obama's rainy Martha's Vineyard vacation. Boo, hoo, hoo. Been raining and raining and raining. He watched DVDs and played at the Blue Heron Farm, a spacious estate rented at $50,000 a week. Obama has a basketball court. I guess he needs night basketball and such. And so there he is. That's the famous first family staying in a $50,000 a week rented estate on Martha's Vineyard. Very creative. There's another very important story. A new high school test that has come out slams Christianity while lauding Islam. State test makers in New York played favorites when quizzing high schoolers on world religions, giving Islam and Buddhism the kid gloves treatment while socking it to Christianity, critics say. You're not going to believe this. Reading selections from the New York Regents Exam in Global History have glowing passages pertaining to Muslim society, but quite critical essays on the subject of Christianity. The most troubling passages came from Daniel Rossell's A World History, A Cultural Approach. The passage reads, quote, "Wherever they went, the Muslims brought with them their love of art, beauty, and learning. From about the 8th to the 11th century, their culture was superior in many ways to that of Western Christendom." Meanwhile, an excerpt listing the common procedures used by Christian friars to introduce the religion in Latin America stated the following. It said, quote, "Idols, temples, and other material evidences of paganism were destroyed, and Christian buildings were often constructed on sites of destroyed native temples and built with free Indian labor to boot." So they gave Islam a pass, and they attacked all the negativity about Christianity. And some are asking, why does the exam have only documents that portray Islam as a religion of peace, civilization, and refinement, while it includes documents about Christianity that show it was anything peaceful in the Spanish conquest of the Americas? And then it goes on, how they present Hernando Cortes' conquest of Mexico, which they say portrayed Cortes as a choir boy rather than a conquistador. So they whitewashed Islam, and they smeared Christianity. That's what your children are learning. It's unbelievable. Listen to what they said about Spain in this textbook and test. Some of the finest centers of Muslim life were established in Spain. In Cordova, the streets were solidly paved, while at the same time in Paris, people waded ankle-deep in mud after a rain. Cordovan public lamps lighted roads for as far as 10 miles. Yet 700 years later, there was still not a single public lamp in London. Wow, shows you what a little head cutting can do. All of this being taught to your children in New York State. That's because you were too busy doing something else. High school tests slam Christianity and Lord Islam. We'll keep talking about this and other topics on the show today, but let's stop for a minute. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. There's another education-related story, which is the construction of the world's most expensive high school in Los Angeles. $578 million school. And, of course, it's a high school for performing arts. You know, the potheads and the drug addicts and the sex maniacs need ornate auditoriums suitable for hosting the Oscars with velvet seats, a dining room that is better than most restaurants, a marble memorial depicting the complex's namesake, state-of-the-art swimming pool, an original pizza oven. And so this was very important. It's a $600 million school for the children who will go into the performing arts. And, of course, no squash court, no hot tub. And I don't know what the poor children are expected to do with their recreation time. I mean, I don't know how children can be expected to learn without such additional necessities. I believe that the $600 million was a little pikerish. And I think that the unions who benefited from this, and God knows who else, who fired teachers and cut back on textbooks to build this mausoleum to stupidity, really did the children harm by not giving them hot tubs. I'll be right back.
Savage.
The media is twisting every story around. They'd have you believe the Ground Zero Mosque is about religious freedom, not sensitivity to those who have fallen on 9/11. Same thing is happening about immigration at the border. The media would have you believe that Arizona's tough stance on immigration is racist, instead of being an attempt to protect Arizona from being overrun by criminals and drug lords. Joining us now is the director of the documentary Border, Chris Burgard, who has seen the problems with the border firsthand. Chris Burgard, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thanks for having me on the show, Doc Savage. Great to be here.
Well, you've been on the border filming the documentary, and I'm sure you've been watching the media spin on Arizona's immigration law. What's the media not showing us about the border?
You hit it straight on the head when you say how it gets spun, because anytime you've got a rancher or law enforcement from Arizona or from Texas or anybody standing up to talk about border security, it gets spun into an immigration issue. And these are two separate topics. Yes, they're related, but right now, let's talk about border security down there. We have a narco-terror war, a regional hemispheric conflict that is manifesting down on our southern border.
Yeah, while the liberals cry about the rights of criminals and illegals.
You have cartel soldados in America claiming operational control of parts of the United States. We have ranchers and residents that live down there that they feel abandoned and even betrayed by the federal government for not protecting them. I have a very good friend that lives down, has a ranch in South Texas. Can you imagine calling your dogs over to you when you come home from work and your dog runs up to you and drops a ball at your foot to go play with, only it's not a ball, it's a human skull from an illegal immigrant that was murdered on your ranch, and the traffic is going through 24/7? That's what these folks are living with down there, and that's what people need to understand. They need to understand the reality of the border.
So, Chris, the media isn't covering this. Why do you think there's such reluctance on the part of the media to cover the truth about the border with Mexico?
You know, That's a very interesting question, but that really concerns me. You know, for the last 5 years, I've seen a big reluctance on the part of media to show the actual truth that's going on the border. I've seen very little motivation on their part to show the perspective of the ranchers, the residents, the local law enforcement that deal with this issue every day. And that concerns me because if you look at what's happened in South America, in Central America, and now Mexico, where journalists are intimidated, they're tortured, they're killed for reporting on this conflict, and as you see the war creep north, I have a concern that is that going to start happening here in America, where we expect to have freedom of the press, but is our media going to be cowed and kept quiet by these same forces?
If so many Americans are in favor of border security, and if strong borders are a natural right of a sovereign nation, why do you think we can't get our policymakers to see what we, the people, are seeing?
Power and money. And the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So you have all these people coming together, from the unions to the politicians to big business to, the drug cartels. A border, a secure border, that it restricts the flow of labor, narcotics, and money. And it's that simple. And so if you follow the money, it'll take you to the politicians, it'll take you to big business, and it will take you to the drug cartels. That's who's profiting by the misery that's happening on the border. And make no mistake, and this is something you never, ever hear a lot of these activists speak about. Americans are being hurt by this, but Mexicans are being hurt by this. I made this movie. One of the things that got me into it was getting to know two illegal aliens from Mexico that would have loved to stay in Mexico, but it's too corrupt down there. The violence was getting too great. They saw their financial salvation as coming to America to make money to send back. The people that are being tortured, the people that are being killed, the majority of these folks are Mexican. These folks are Hispanic. Why isn't someone standing up and saying, we need to stop the violence against Hispanics down on the border?
Okay, so you saw the problem firsthand. You met people on both sides of the debate, including illegals. With what you've seen, where do you see solutions coming from?
We can get, the first thing you do is you can get your lawmakers, to your leaders, just enforce the rules that are on the books. The Border Patrol, the first thing Border Patrol will tell you that they need help with is cut off the flow of jobs, which is what's luring so many folks here. Because what the Border Patrol has been saying for years is, look, if we weren't flooded with illegal aliens at the border, we'd be able to have to go after the bad guys, guys with the narcotics. And that's evidence is by what's happened this last year. Traffic was down about 25%. But yet they had an increase of almost 50% in narcotic seizures. We can secure the border. People need to understand it's not a matter of how do we do it. It's a matter of having the will.
Well, this is going to take a lot of will because, as you say, power and money has a lot of will of its own.
When I was down in Hachita, New Mexico a few years ago, they shut off the biggest cocaine trafficking corridor in New Mexico by putting a striker unit on the border. That sent a message. And that allowed the Border Patrol to move their personnel around and beef up some other areas. It was a huge force multiplier. What cannot happen in this country is you can't trick the American people into thinking that we're protecting them and securing our border when, in fact, we're not. It's an illusion. It's a dog and pony show.
We're speaking with Chris Bergard, who himself has spent time on the border filming a documentary called Border. So, Chris, you're saying that all of our so-called border initiatives are a dog and pony show? What do you mean by that?
I'll just give you one for instance. A lot of Americans think because we've spent so much money on the fence that we're safe. But you go to Hudspeth County, Texas, where in 2006 they had an armed incursion of Mexican military, Humvees, on our side of the border protecting drug shipments. There was a standoff between Texas law enforcement and the Mexican military. Well, they finally came down there and built the fence, but the fence stops 500 yards short of Neely's Crossing where these Humvees came across. And in that three-mile section of fence, there are two 12-foot gaps that you can drive a truck through down to and across the river. Now, I bet there's not an American in the country that thought, hey, we built the fence, but we left holes in it on purpose. It just doesn't make sense.
No, that's right. Any right-thinking American would look at that policy and see it for what it is. Nonsense. But Chris, after you film this documentary, do you feel hopeful about conditions changing on the border?
Yes. The more people I think we may be approaching a tipping point. I mean, this is why we made Border. When you see Border you understand the real scenario of what's going on down there. I was invited to screen border for the House and for the Senate, and I remember a staffer from Ted Kennedy's office coming up to me after the movie and going, "We didn't know. We didn't know it was like this." We have to educate ourselves. Americans will make the right decisions. Americans will put the right pressure on their politicians to enforce the laws when they see how bad the situation really is down there. And that's why we need to educate ourselves. I'm not asking America to think like me. I'm just asking America to think. Pay attention. Participate. We need an engaged citizenry to participate in this very, very important issue for our people.
Chris, I couldn't agree with you more on that point. The American people have the right instincts, and when they know the truth, they'll know what needs to be done. Chris Bergard, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate all you're doing for this country and all you're doing to help educate and wake up everyday Americans. Please, pay attention, participate, see border, and make up your mind for yourself. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
The mantra of the Savage Nation is borders, language, and culture. And every American who hears that understands immediately what it means. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You guys smacked my camera. The guy hit me. Sir,
what's your objective of being
please,
here right
please,
now?
Please, to document what's going on.
Okay, but the police... Sorry, we got someone over here. Let's go.
Bigots, go home! Bigots, go home! Bigots, go home!
Your mind is made up. Your doxies are set in place. You think it's a freedom of religion idea when, in fact, it has nothing to do with freedom of religion. It's all about the site, not about the mosque. This just shows you how you've mixed up set and frame. It's not only about the mosque. It's also about the sacred nature of the burial ground of 9/11. It's a war site. It would be as building a mosque, let's say, next to Arlington National Cemetery. Same exact thing. Would you say, well, why shouldn't they? Well, I would say, why should they? But 9/11 is a little different than that even, because it was 19 Muslims who flew the planes into the World Trade Center. If you don't know that, then you're an idiot. Your brain is washed. So you say, well, what does that have to do with all the other Muslims? The answer is nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But the site itself is sacred. There are 100 other mosques in New York City. Let them take it elsewhere and build it somewhere else. Don't go for the liberal platitude that it's about freedom of religion. It isn't. It's not freedom of worship. It's about a sacred site called Ground Zero. The mosque could be moved. And if these agitators really cared about getting along with their neighbors of the Christian and Jewish faith, they would have moved it by now. They would have said, we never thought this would provoke such outrage. We're not wed to it. We want to get along with you. We live in America. We're not going to impose this on you. We're moving it. But they haven't said that. Daisy Khan and Mr. Imam, who's on a surprisingly disappearing trip in the Middle East with your tax money, he didn't say that. They dug their heels in, and the Arab developer dug his heels in. And the spokesmouth for the Muslim American Society, he dug his heels in. You'll do what we want. This is our America. You'll do what we want. And you go along like you're the Stockholm Syndrome. Oh, yeah, well, that's what a debate is all about in a free society. So last week on the Savage Nation, I took some time out to be interviewed by David Brody of the Christian Broadcasting Network. Let's listen in.
So if you're stuck on a desert island with Pelosi, Rachel Maddow, Keith Olbermann, who would you go on that desert island? If you had to choose one of them.
The sharks. I would choose the sharks. I would take my chances with the sharks.
I love it. Is there one?
I lived in the South Pacific. I think I could have a better chance with sharks.
I love it. Listen, what do you miss from the Bronx?
Nothing. I haven't been there since I'm a boy. I mean, the Bronx that existed when I was a child, Yankee Stadium, right. Hot dogs, people who are all dead who are living, a sense of community, walking out of the tenement and everybody was friendly. All the parents were on the stoop, on the curb, all the moms were there. You could walk out in the street and no one ever heard of a child being touched by a stranger because they would have been killed by the moms with the umbrellas. And children were safe. It was a beautiful, it was a different time. So I didn't know that we were poor. I had no idea we were poor until looking back. Hey, we were poor. To me, it was paradise. So that doesn't exist anymore.
All right. So, you know, look, health is important to you. I mean, you've beyond writing books about everything
I've written
under
health
the sun.
Books, right.
Right. I mean, what's the big advice to give people for longevity in life?
Oh, you're asking me? I'd be the last person on earth to answer it because I know I'm begging fate.
Ah.
I'm tempting fate to do that.
What do you need to do to stay healthy?
I'm on borrowed time. My father died young, may he rest in peace. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, all from heart disease. So it drove me into my graduate work, my travels all over the South Seas for 20 years, looking for the cures and the plants, and I wrote 20 books on health and nutrition. Do I know that I found the answer? I would say, thus far, thank God, the vitamins, the diet, right? But my stress level is through the roof. If stress killed people, I should have been dead at 5.
Garlic pills. What about garlic pills?
I use garlic. I don't use garlic pills.
Why not?
Because fresh garlic is different than what you wind up with the pill. Unless you're selling them, I have to tell you.
No,
you want fresh garlic, and you want it. By the way, it's interesting. You have to crush the garlic to release the sulfur compounds that are protective.
Mm.
So you should take a knife and smash it before you use it in your cooking.
Have you thought about going on the Food Network at all?
I thought about a cooking show and doing my politics around the cooking.
Did you really?
Oh, many people.
Is that true?
People have asked me to do it. You heard my famous story about meatballs, haven't you?
No, I haven't heard that.
Years ago, I said on the radio show that when America was great in the 50s. The meatballs were large and fluffy and tasty.
Right.
And as the years have gone on, the meatballs have become small and mean and tasteless, like Swedish meatballs because we've become socialist, like the Swedes.
Very
now,
nice.
Now picture me cooking meatballs and spaghetti and holding them up to the camera and saying, you see this meatball? You see this meatball? This is when America was great. Look what it's become, a mean little meatball because we become mean like this socialist country.
So a food and politics show, putting it all together.
What would the name of the show
be? What would the name? That's a good question. What would the name of the show be?
Well, you know, they say the word sauté means cooking in a pan. I don't know. Call it Michael's sauté pan. Hold it. I got it. Here's the show.
What's the show? Yes, tell.
Out of the frying pan with Michael Savage.
I love it. All right, last question.
You can produce the show and be the co-host. You could ask me all these goofy questions about cooking.
That's right. I'll do that. All right, last question. I'm sure you have a list of pet peeves in your life. Do you got a top pet peeve? What's one thing that drives you
noise pollution.
Like what's going on here with me?
No. It's a controlled environment.
Mm-hmm. Noise pollution.
Okay, flying in an airplane, loud people talking that you have no way to get out of there.
Mm.
Cell phones in a restaurant. People screaming in the, neighbors with loud stereos are obvious.
Drive you insane.
Leaf blowers. Ban them. Fireplaces. Outlaw them in the suburbs and cities. Only permit them in rural areas. It's pollution. I have a fireplace, but it's gas. No more wood-burning fireplaces. They say, wow. How could a conservative say that? Because you're destroying the air. It's the most fundamental freedom we have is the right to breathe.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, what's your favorite dessert? You like desserts?
I don't eat them.
You don't eat any desserts?
I eat grapes, red grapes.
Okay, so you're a fruit guy.
I never eat dessert except grapes and fruit. You're into food? I mean, you do a food show?
No, but I am into food.
Eat red grapes because it's as good as drinking red wine without the alcohol.
Is that true? I believe you, by the way.
No, but you're trying to get the polyphenols out of the grape in the wine. So you don't have to get drunk to get the polyphenolic compounds. You get them from red grapes or grape juice. Same exact benefits without the alcohol. I'm not arguing against drinking, but you don't have to drink to get the benefits.
Right. Thank you so much.
All right. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Probably haven't heard this sound yet, but you need to listen to the rabid radical protesters in New York City demanding that the Victory Mosque be built on the graves of those who died on 9/11. Here's one of the lovely, peaceful Muslims at the pro-mosque parade.
Everything the previous speaker said, I feel deeply in my heart. I would like nothing more than to go and confront the racists who are just one block away from here. People should know
Right on.
And yet they can only put 150 people on the streets.
That's right.
That is because their politics of hate and racism and fear cannot win the day.
Did you hear that? The peace-loving Muslim just called you a racist if you question the Ground Zero Victory Mosque. But wait, it gets worse. You're the one terrorizing them, not the other way around.
We will not let you get away with this. We will not let you terrorize and intimidate our Arab and Muslim brothers and sisters. But there are also not enough of us now. We need more people, and we need to send a message to the Arabs and Muslims and people from South Asia and people oppressed across this country that they do not need to be afraid. Because there are many people who are home right now who can watch us and see what we are doing and want to see, can you come up and fight? Can you stand up and not get crushed? This is the beginning of a movement. This is the beginning of a fight. We need to go out and organize the hundreds and thousands of people agree with us, who feel what we feel deep in their heart, but we're afraid to come out today, but we'll be here next time. That has to be our vision.
Well, there are millions who disagree with her. Here's another moron who's trying to paint all mosque opponents as racists.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a wonderful day, and you are the reason who gives the honor to the New York City. And we always stand against the racism.
Stand against racism? You're saying against America. You're standing against the dead of 9/11. You're standing against most Americans. I'm not going to say what I think. Play the next clip.
There will be no racism in this country. There will be no bigotry in this country. There will be a freedom of speech, freedom of religion. That's what you stand. And those people who don't understand this thing, they have the very, very narrow reason in their mind. They have no plan. They start the war.
Wait, stop
they
the tape
start
again.
The war.
Who started the war? The Islamofascists started the war. But we'll finish it. But wait, you have to listen to this. This is where the real hatred from the Islamofascists comes in.
You are the one who's going to let them know. You want to win the election? Come out with a plan of the future. This is not a future to bomb Pakistan when the people are dying. This is not a future of this country supporting the Jewish Zionist Israel. This is not a future of this country.
This is the worst kind of anti-Semitism imaginable. Okay, keep going.
Who will not say, stand for the love?
I can't.
So we are... You are
Zionist Israel?
Heroes.
What's up with that, dude?
You're all of the heroes. So we're going to come down on September 11th, too, and let the world know what the New York City stands.
Why are you going to be racist?
Stand for the love and the respect. Stand for the love and the respect.
Love and respect? You're being racist.
Well, that's a good question. Whoever that reporter was, he's actually doing his job. This is racism. This is anti-Semitism. That's what's behind this mosque. Remember the words of the imam.
We tend to forget in the West that the United States has more Muslim blood on its hands than Al-Qaeda has on its hands of innocent non-Muslims. You may remember that that the U.S.-led sanction against Iraq led to the death of over 500,000 Iraqi children. This has been documented by the United Nations. And when Madeleine Albright, who has become a friend of mine over the last couple of years, when she was Secretary of State and was asked whether this was worth it, said it was worth it.
He's actually blaming the U.S. He's saying we're worse than Al-Qaeda. And listen to him talk about the 72 virgins that awaits all Muslims.
Just about 2 months ago, I was interviewed by Barbara Walters, who's doing a special on heaven. And she's interviewed suicide bombers who were expecting the embraces of 72 virgins in paradise. And she asked me, do women get the same privilege as well? And I answered her, telling her, well, the Quran says, you shall have whatever your heart desires.
And wait, all this is going on, and what's our commander-in-chief up to? Playing basketball, night basketball on Martha's Vineyard.
It's been raining since Sunday, with more expected today. So what's a vacationing president to do? Last night, the first couple dined out with friends at the aptly named Sweet Life Cafe. The president spent Monday watching DVDs and playing the board game Taboo at Blue Heron Farm, the spacious $20 million estate the first family rented at a cost of up to $50,000 a week. It has a half-court basketball court, but the court's outdoors. So with some pals and underlings, the president headed out to play basketball at Oak Bluffs Elementary School. Some of the lights went out, but not enough lights to stop.
I don't want to hear anymore. Turn it off. So what do you want to talk about? Iran, the mosque, Martha's Vineyard. I want to talk about Martha's Vineyard, where the grapes of wrath are not only stored, but the wine from the grapes of wrath is what the Bacchanalians get drunk on every night as they plot the next bubble in order to sucker you in and suck the money out. I mean, the housing bubble created by them, you know that. So what's the next bubble you think that the people on Martha's Vineyard are going to cook up as they drink the next vintage of the grapes of wrath? Hawaii, Jimmy, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, you know, before I went into the Army, I went up to Martha's Vineyard to be a waiter and paint houses. And that is the elite of the elitist place. You know, they pretty much treat you like crap up there.
In other words, they look down on the working man, even though that's how they get to power, by telling everyone, by giving the speeches that they're for the working man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know
some of the names that play in Martha's Vineyard. I understand it very well. I have no jealousy for it, Jimmy. I live in beautiful properties. It means nothing to me to hang around with these people one way or the other. I'm sure some of them are decent. Some of them are indecent. They just happen to be different than you and I in that they have more money. Remember what Hemingway said? The rich are different. No, it was F. Scott Fitzgerald who wrote, "The rich are different than you and I. They have more money." Remember that one?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's about it. In other words, they range all over the place. The rich are different than you and I. They have more money. That's all. But they range in type. That's all, just as we do. There's no defining the rich or the elite in any one way that would make any sense, other than they tend to sneer or denigrate the working man, which is ironic in the sense that they use the working man to get where they are politically, and particularly the Democrats, Jimmy. How are things in Hawaii today, since you're calling from there, Jimmy? What island are you on?
I'm on Oahu, right in Honolulu.
I happen to love Honolulu. You know, when I go to the islands, it's where I choose to stay, is Honolulu.
Yeah, it's a good city.
You know, here's the reason. You got a diversity of restaurants. I get very bored easily on like islands. I did too much of it as a young man. I like Honolulu because I know where to go. I can get into remote areas of Oahu that you would think you're on a lost island. Have you ever been back in Manoa Valley up in the ridges there and gone down the Ko'olau Range?
I live in Manoa, Doctor.
Well, I lived in Manoa, and I used to hike back on the ridges, and I'll tell you, there are people who got lost and that have never been found. So you say Oahu, people don't realize what's right in the back of the valley from Waikiki, Jimmy.
Yeah, you're right.
Right? Yeah. And the ocean is gorgeous right off, like Waikiki. I like to go swimming. There's a beach I used to love by the Alawai Yacht Harbor down by the end there. All of the hippies hang out. Smoke the doobies. They're in the trucks and the vans and the surfer kids. They don't work there. How do they make a living without working?
A lot of them work at night in the restaurants and stuff and surf during the day. And I was just down at the beach now. I'm on a break from lunch, and I go down to Ala Moana Beach and swim in the afternoons. You know, I love it.
Right, Ala Moana Beach. It's a beautiful beach. I'm one of the few people who actually enjoys Ala Moana Shopping Center when I go there. The food is very good, by the way, in the food court.
Right, yeah, I love the food
court. No, it is. No, if you know where to go, the food court is very... I like food courts in big shopping centers. They're very good.
I agree.
And you know why? Because people who don't have much money are pretty picky about what they eat, by the way. When they're going to spend it, it better be good, and they're not going to go back. Unlike the restaurants that Mayor Bloomberg goes to, where, frankly, they could serve him warmed over you-know-what, and he'd go back to it because it keeps out riffraff like you.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you.
I'm joking. Come on. The one thing I can't stand is poi. I remember when I first got to Hawaii and, I wanted to go native and eat native food. Ooh, is that stuff horrible? I can't eat it. And even the years I lived in Fiji, they didn't even eat poi. The Fijians took taro and they cooked the taro root. That I love. To this day, I love taro root. But you can't get it in America in many places. You have to know how to cook it, by the way. Taro root has to be cooked twice. Very tough to cook. You see how strong these Fijian men are? They're like iron men. They're Melanesians. They're like iron men. And the traditional diet was largely consisted of root crops and vegetables and some fish, with the occasional mammal, meaning boar. They would go pig hunting in the mountains with spears, by the way. But the staple food was kava, excuse me, was what I just mentioned to you. So you do is you cut the root up and you boil it, and then you throw the water out, and then you boil it again. Why do you have to do it twice? Because there are microcrystallines in the taro that wind up that are removed during the cooking process. And if you don't cook it thoroughly, you wind up getting these microcrystalline substances absorbed, and you could damage your kidneys and your intestines. How did the islanders figure out not to eat taro without cooking it twice? To think about the technology and how long it took, what trial and error is. And you know, as a student at the time who studied primitive culture and primitive food and primitive medicine, it's pretty astounding technology when you think about it. And the wisdom of the people who developed these medicines from the wild, or developed the idea of how to cook these foods without killing themselves, is astonishing.
Savage.